The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
The main character of Plug is dirty and disgusting, and there's a scene in this film and you see he's got his big mutton chops, he's wearing a hat, he's making these grunting sounds.
The terrible Australian, Bea Jemine.
Marcy, there's a scene for poor Barry McKenzie where French police shoot up an entire box of Foster's beer with machine guns.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
Absolutely nothing. There's nothing there. This is shit. This is a shithole of a movie.
Mature themes.
I knew it was going to be a documentary about sex, but I thought it would be more about love and relationships and stuff like that. I didn't realize it was going to be about venereal diseases.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is Bea Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 17 of the Ozploitcast, the podcast where my co-host Super Marcy and I take a deep dive into Australia's Ozploitation movement from the very beginning right until today. And with me, as always, is my very Aussie co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
G'day, Bede. Doing well. Feeling ultra Aussie today for some reason.
Yes. Not for any particular reason. You just feel very Aussie today.
I just feel very Aussie right now.
Although you just need an Australian flag, you need a Southern Cross tattoo, and also you need one of those hats with the little bottle things on them, so
they can swipe
the corks, yes, get rid of all the flies.
No, I don't know, that just seems a little bit too over the top.
Indeed. Well, we're back now, Marcy, for another episode of our little show, the Ozploitcast. So we're about to hit the halfway mark of the 80s, which is very exciting because we're halfway there, Marcy. We don't know what the rest of the decade is going to bring, but we do have some pretty exciting stuff in this episode. However, though, it'll only just be us for this episode, so there'll be no guests for this one. But that being said, though, we have an exciting show lined up for all of our listeners. And for this episode of the show, we're going to be looking at the films One Night Stand, Razorback, Leonora, Fortress, and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Yes, five very interesting and intriguing titles, and actually, for once, two are actually films I've seen before, and if anyone can guess, they're the ones that are more well-known.
And also, it's kind of a little bit of everything, too, because you've got a sort of apocalyptic drama, then you've got a kidnapping thriller, then you have a killer animal horror film, then you have a dystopian action film, and I guess a very sexy movie in there as well.
Yeah, and we'll certainly have things to say about that one.
Indeed. So we might as well get straight to it and talk about our very first film for this episode, which, of course, is the 1984 drama One Night Stand.
U.S. Navy's known for months.
We repeat
it's on!
Lines again.
What is?
NATO and Warsaw
the
Pact
war, goddammit!
Locked in battle.
World War III!
All people in the greater Sydney area are to stay inside their houses.
How do you feel? Calm.
Well, I guess we should try and cheer them up. Have our own private party. Good luck.
Maybe one night left to live your whole life. One Night Stand.
Well, what about the radiation?
Oh, I know where there's some umbrellas. Would have died down by now.
Thank you. I can think of doing is playing strip poker. It's pathetic.
I suppose we should make the most of it in case.
Right.
Further information confirms that London, huge areas of central and southeastern England, and the industrial areas of France, including Paris, have virtually ceased to exist.
It's like the whole world's dead.
Maybe one night left to live your whole life. One night stand.
Which was written and directed by John Dugan, and it stars Tyler Coppin, Cassandra Delaney, Jay Hackett, and Saskia Post. And the plot summary for this one is, in Australia, four teenagers in a Sydney theatre are astounded to hear the news that a nuclear war has broken out in Eastern Europe. They try to figure out the best way they can survive the coming flagration. Now, Marcy, I knew of One Night Stand, mainly because of the film's director, John Dugan, who, from what I understand, this was his debut film as a director, but he would also go on later on down the line to direct a couple of well-known Aussie classics, including the films The Year My Voice Broke and its sequel, Flirting, which actually starred Nicole Kidman, Naomi Watts, and Tandaway Newton. So I've been wanting to see One Night Stand for quite a while, especially because I knew that it was a film that was set with an upcoming apocalypse. But the question is, though, what do we think of One Night Stand? Marcy, your thoughts on this movie?
Yes, unlike you, I actually had not heard of this film. And before watching it, I didn't read a synopsis or anything, so I had no idea what I was in for. Going just by the title, One Night Stand, I thought, oh God, is this going to be some kind of like weird sex movie about one night stands or something? No, not at all. but that is not what this movie was. Instead, I would call it, if I were to describe it, I would call it if you mixed Miracle Mile with a John Hughes teen film. And that's One Night Stand, set in the Sydney Opera House during New Year's Eve, where it looks like World War III is coming and they're under the threat of nuclear attacks. Through the film, it's two girls who are friends and they sort of know one of the guys that shows up. He ends up being a cleaner at the theater, and this other runaway army officer. And so through the night, they experience so much and we see flashbacks to their lives. They try to find out what's happening using a radio and eventually finding a TV. And it's all about dealing with this impending doom. And there's memorable moments, some funny moments. And I think it's held together by four pretty good performances. And then the ending is just so sad and bleak. It really left me feeling sorry for what was happening. And again, just a reminder that I don't fucking want to have a World War III and have shit like this happen.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, well, like you, even though I knew about this film, I still wasn't sure what to expect. The only thing I kind of really knew about it was that the film was going to be taking place on the eve of a nuclear fallout and how a bunch of characters were going to deal with such an event. And it's kind of interesting when you look at this film and when it came out. This was around the time in the early 80s where the Cold War was at its height and the possible threat of nuclear annihilation was a wrap, because there was a lot of different films and TV films that were released around this time, like the films The Day After or Testament. So One Night Stand is definitely a film that, like those ones, explores it. But you're right, though. It kind of does it in an interesting way by having it from the point of view of a group of teenagers.
Yeah.
And particularly because you got these two guys, then you got these two girls. And, of course, how they sort of all meet, because the two guys pretty much essentially work as Santa Clauses for a shop, and then they see the girls and they thought, oh, let's go like chat them up and see if we can try to go out on a date with them. And they do, and the girls are a little bit sus on them, but they figured they'd just go along with it. But then, of course, during the first half, the date doesn't go well. And then one of the guys leaves, and then they come across... Well, actually, what's interesting, though, is that during the first half of this film, we are introduced to an American sailor who has gone AWOL in Sydney because he is fully aware about everything that is going on with the upcoming nuclear attack. So he's going through his own struggles. And then, of course, he and one of the guys and also the two girls eventually just meet up at the Sydney Opera House. And that's when they find out through the news that a nuclear apocalypse is upon us. And you're right, though. It is a very nightmarish situation that they're in. Mm. And whenever I do watch films like this, it does put me on edge, which I know you feel the same way about as well. I think what makes this one interesting is the relationships between these four characters and their relationships to each other, because they sort of get to know each other a little bit more. We get to know more about this American sailor and how much turmoil he's going through, knowing about what is going to happen. But also these characters and them trying to figure out what to do and thinking about what has happened in their lives and whether everything they wish they could have done more or maybe even took a chance on a few things. And of course, you get to see that at least with some of the characters, they do get together during the course of it. But you're right, though. I think what really kind of leaves an impact on this film is the very final scene where our main characters just go down into the Sydney Underground train stations where there's a whole bunch of different people. And all you can hear is like big, loud noises from up above. And everything goes black. And the characters are just all there kind of not sure what's going on the surface. And basically that's where the end credits happen. And you kind of just get a lot more the sound effects of people talking and it's just in a very effective way to end the film because you don't know what's going to happen to these characters.
You don't know if there's any chance if they survive it or what actually is going to happen. So it does sort of end on this very uneasy and eerie feeling. And it is certainly very effective, especially after you've spent the film getting to know these characters, and they do become like quite likable as you get to know them more. And I will say, with how it starts off, like the two girls with two guys, and I'm thinking, oh, they're going to hook up and have some one night stand, and then that doesn't happen. And then it's like, oh shit, there's like a fucking nuclear war is going to break out. Holy shit, it's not what I was expecting at all.
And I should state that the characters in the film, their names, I should say, you've got the character of Sam, who is the American sailor played by Tyler Coppin. Then, of course, the two girls, Eva and Sharon, who are played by Saskia Post and Cassandra Delaney. And then finally, Jay Hackett, who plays the role of Brendan. However, though, the other actor who plays his friend, who also tries to date the girls, is David Pledger. And Marcy, is it just me, or did David Pledger look exactly like Richard Gere, but so much so that even the movie itself has one of the characters saying the exact same thing and comment on it?
Yeah, a little bit.
But here's the thing, though. I am about to blow your mind, Marcy. Does that actor, David Pledger, the Richard Gere lookalike, does he look very familiar to you? Other than looking like Richard
Gere. I think I was too distracted by the Richard Gere-ness.
What if I told you later on in his career, he would play the dad in Lake Mungo?
Oh.
And I only just discovered this right now.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. That's an interesting bit of trivia.
But yeah, I was really surprised about this. But given that this is John Dugan who wrote and directed the film, and this is his debut, and knowing the type of films he would make down the track, it's kind of not surprising that this was a film that, yes, even though it does deal with a very sort of dark sci-fi premise, it does focus on its characters and the relationships between each other.
Yeah, it sort of explores like, what if this was your last night or heading into the unknown, and the characters all go through their different arcs with how they deal and process with what's happening. And it feels very real and very raw. And I liked that about the film.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And yes, no, after I did watch it, I did look up John Dugan and saw what else he'd done. And I'm like, oh, yep, okay, this makes sense now.
And in terms of trivia, before we go to our final ratings of this film, footage of the Australian rock band Midnight Oil was taken from their Midnight Oil Show concert staged in Sydney and filmed and recorded on the 18th of September 1983. I do like the fact that we do get a performance from Midnight Oil in this film, and knowing the type of band they are, and especially were at the time, since they were a very political and socially conscious band, it would make sense to have them perform a song in this film at a concert.
As I started the film and they showed up, I'm like, holy shit, there's Midnight Oil performing a concert in this film. I might add, trivia is all credited to IMDb, so if anything is not actually true, we blame IMDb, because that's where we got it from.
Exactly, exactly. Also, in terms of other IMDb trivia, filming at the Sydney's famed Opera House was limited to 10 days due to the extensive hire cost to rent the venue, which is pretty surprising given that I would say about at least the second and third halves of the film are set at the Opera House.
Yeah, and it's really impressive with everything they were able to do in that 10 days as well. Like, you can imagine some of these scenes would have taken a bit of time to do. But yeah, I'm impressed they pulled those scenes off in 10 days. That's quite an achievement.
Definitely. And also, the film in 1984 won the Casa de Catalunya, and if I butchered that, please forgive me, award for best cinematography at the Stig's International Fantasy and Horror Film Festival in Catalonia as part of the wider Catalonian International Film Festival. So yeah, it's kind of interesting it won that award. Like, I know the film didn't get nominated for any Australian Film Institute awards that year, but at least a well-known international genre film festival at least acknowledged the film in that way with the cinematography.
Yeah, and it does. It is a really stunning looking film. Like, I would love a restoration of this. Now that we're talking about it, maybe Umbrella has been listening.
Well, I mean, Umbrella did release this on DVD a couple of years.
Yes, but we're talking about Blu-ray here.
Well, I know that, but I mean, if they've released it on DVD, so hopefully, fingers crossed, they'll do a restoration and release it on Blu-ray. According to the Oz Movies website, it states that the film failed to perform theatrically. According to Film Victoria report on Australian box office, it only did only $111,978,000 in business, equivalent to in Australian 2009 as $284,462,000. It did get a release on VHS in the US and in Japan and in some European territories, but it didn't do theatrical business elsewhere. So this movie kind of continues the trend of a lot of Ozploitation films we have covered on this show, where the film itself surprisingly did not do that well at the box office. But given the subject matter that it has, I can't really blame audiences kind of not wanting to see this, especially it's a film that deals with nuclear war during a time when the Cold War was at its height.
I can imagine this might have been, like, people may have watched it a bit on, like, VHS at the video store, but I'm not too sure. It just seems like the kind of movie you'd see the cover of and be like, yeah, I'll take it home, see what's like.
Yeah, I can imagine people renting this movie based on its cover, especially if you look at the original theatrical poster. And be like, oh, it's a movie about teenagers, let's rent this movie. It's like, oh, there's nuclear war in this movie. Oh, geez. And finally, protest and demonstration scenes filmed in the city of Sydney featured around 20,000 people, according to the film's executive producer, Simon Windsor, who is a filmmaker we have talked about on this show before, because he also directed the films Snapshot and Harlequin. So I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of One Night Stand. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
I give this one 4. I don't want to be dealing with what they're dealing with, out of 5. I think it is a really fantastic film. It's a great debut feature for a writer and director as well, and something I highly recommend people check out.
I'm going to give this a 3.5 out of 5 myself. It is a really solid film, and a very well-made one with some pretty strong performances from its cast, and a subject matter that, while it does bring a lot of humor to the film, it does treat the idea of an upcoming nuclear apocalypse very seriously. So the film does feel a little tonally jarring at times, but that being said, though, it is a pretty solid movie, and I would definitely like to see a new restoration of this film down the line. Umbrella, if you're listening to this show, and I have a good feeling that you are, definitely bring this movie to Blu-ray. I think more people need to see it.
Agreed.
Now, moving right along to our second film, which I would also say is one of the big ones for this episode of the show, which, of course, is the 1984 horror film Razorback.
Somewhere in the Australian outback, he is waiting.
Something big scared him away.
Like what?
I don't know. But it was huge. It was as big as a rhino.
Jake Cullen, the obsessed hunter, determined to stop
it. To come to the waterhole to drink.
Jake, get some help. Andy will...
No, he's mine.
You're a Pathfinder.
Animal campaigner?
And dumped at the Pet Pack Cannery 8 miles west of here.
The American animal campaigner who got more than the story she bargained for.
Don't rub her up!
She wasn't very popular around here.
What did you do to my wife, Benny?
And the crazed brothers who protected their own secrets at all costs.
You ask too many bloody questions, you know that?
Do you know what happened to her? Razorbacks.
Carl Winters searching for the answers.
Godless vermin. He's only got two states of being. Dangerous or dead.
That boar destroyed his life.
Now, listen, Bill, you're in the middle of bugger all here, so for Christ's sake, don't go walkabout. We'll never find you. And we'll be back in 5 or 6 hours.
Gregory Harrison, in his first major motion picture, running for his life.
You're gonna do it, just bloody do it.
Hello?
Come on, man, shoot me! You finished the kangaroo! Shoot me!
Produced by Hal McElroy from Australia's hottest new director, Russell Mulcahy. Razorback.
He's only got two states of being.
Dangerous or dead. Razorback,
which was directed by Russell Mulcahy, written by a screenwriter who we have talked about a lot on this show, Everett DeRoach, based on the novel of the same name by Peter Brennan. This film stars Gregory Harrison, Arky Whiteley, Bill Kerr, Chris Haywood, another name we keep talking about, David Argue, another name we have talked about on this show, Judy Morris, another one who we've talked about on the show before, and John Howard.
No, that's not the former Prime Minister John Howard. Yeah, I think that's John Howard.
We have to kind of let our audience know we're not talking about former Prime Minister John Howard. We're talking about actor John Howard.
Exactly.
And the plot summary for this film, which I'm reading from IMDb, is: as a vicious wild boar terrorizes the Australian outback, the husband of one of the victims is joined by a hunter and a farmer in search for the beast. Now, Marcy, I think it's pretty fair to say when people think of Australian horror film, I would imagine some of the ones people would think about would be The Babadook, Wolf Creek, Patrick. But I would guarantee one of the first ones people would think about alongside those ones I just mentioned would be Razorback. And it's hard not to understand why, because even though the film in a lot of ways was basically made to capitalize on the success of Jaws by basically having a giant wild boar as the killer animal at the center of it, or as the movie was promoted as quite a lot in the lead up to its release as Jaws on Trotters, But the film has become a cult classic in Australia. And I think when people do think of Australian horror, this is one of the ones that they think about the most. But the question is, what did we think of it? Marcy, your thoughts on this film?
Yeah, I think Razorback is definitely one of the ones that when you think of Australian horror, it certainly comes to mind. It is basically Outback Jaws. It does sort of have a lot of those the same beats as Jaws. But I feel like there was certainly an inspiration for sort of having the dad character lose, I think it's the grandson, to the vicious boar and people not believing that's what happened. I think some of that is a reflection of the Azaria Chamberlain case, which I think that was in 1980, so a few years before this. And it definitely mirrors that a lot, but you've just kind of put this Jaws in the Outback element to it as well. So there's certainly a few things going on. And it's interesting because it sort of, you think that the main character is going to be the lady that shows up, but it's not. It does the old psycho by killing off who you think the main character is as well. So there's definitely some Hitchcock in this as well. And I think part of what makes it work is it's paced very well. It tells its story really, really well. And it is absolutely gorgeous to look at. Like, not surprising that Russell Mulcahy got Highlander from Razorback. You can definitely tell this is a music video director, but that doesn't take anything away with it, because there's certainly substance with the style, and it certainly has a style. It's very visually striking. I think what kind of puts it out of the film a little bit is the Chris Haywood and David Argue characters just don't really fit the tone of this movie, and they're really rapey, and it's disturbing. And I really wanted more vicious, like, death to come to them. I really did. They play it well. I just don't think it quite suited the rest of the film. But with that said, I do adore Razorback.
Yeah, I have an interesting history with Razorback. I would say, Marcy, and I'm not even lying about this, Razorback was probably one of the earliest Australian horror films I heard about as a kid. Because, again, I stayed away from horror as a child. I was too terrified of a lot of horror films, but my siblings did watch them. And I believe one time, and maybe this is just me misremembering, but I just have a very vivid memory that one time when I was a kid, my older siblings were watching Razorback, and I think I walked in at the beginning of the film when the Razorback takes Jake's grandson. And I think that scene freaked me out so much that I honestly thought that a wild boar was going to come and take me in the middle of the night.
To be fair, you were like in the middle of nowhere. So that is a very valid fear, actually.
Exactly. And I think, and there was one that my siblings and other people I knew would talk about a lot. And I've seen Razorback quite a number of times over the years. I do have a lot of fondness for this film. And I got to say, like, I completely agree with you. I think this is a really solid killer animal film. But I think what makes this one really stand out is, of course, the direction from Russell Mulcahy. I know this was his second film, but up to this point, Russell Mulcahy, most of his work had been in music videos, particularly directing a lot of music videos for Duran Duran and Elton John. So I think he might have been one of the earliest music video directors to transition to filmmaking.
I think so. But it's interesting because when you watch, like, his other films, like, as I mentioned, Highlander, there's certainly, like, this music video element to how that is visually. And again, it's another film that is so visually striking. There's so many bits in that film that are just very memorable and that people remember.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's one of the key things that makes Razorback such a memorable film as it is its visual style. And we also need to give a shout out to Dean Sebler, who is a cinematographer we've talked about on the show before, because he also shot Mad Max 2 and a few other films we have done. And both Russell Mulcahy and Dean Sebler, like, their work on this film is phenomenal. Like, every time I watch this film, I just forget how visually striking it is.
Like, even though, like, you've seen it and there's really, like, fantastic 4K restoration out there as well that you can see on Blu-ray and 4K. But yeah, like even seeing it like that and then watching it again like that, it's like, it just, it's still, it's like watching it for the first time that it's like, wow, some of these shots are truly like magical.
Oh yeah. Like Russell Mulcahy and Dean Semler didn't need to go as hard as they did with the visual look of this film, but they did and we're deeply appreciative of it. Mm. And also the film visually, as stunning as it is, it can be very weird at times. Like one of the things I never noticed until I watched the 4K of this film is in the scene where the characters of Benny and Dicko, played by Chris Haywood and David Argue, when they chase after Judy Morris's character of Beth and they have her. Now, David Argue is, of course, attempting to sexually assault her. But then at one point, I believe Benny shines a light on Dicko and then his eyes just, when he turns around, just look like the eyes of like an animal when you shine a light on it and their eyes just go bright white. Like there's little surreal touches like that throughout the course of the film, particularly with that really weird sequence where Gregory Harrison, when he's left stranded in the bush by Benny and Dicko, and he's just wandering around the desert and he's just coming across all these like very surreal moments, including that run in with the skeletal horse as well.
Like, I'd almost forgotten about that. And it's like, why does Razorback kind of get wake and fright for a bit there?
Well, that's the thing, though. Every time I watch this film, like, I know the Jaws comparisons are very apt, but to me, this film, if I had to describe what this film is like to people now, I'm just basically to describe it as, well, Razorback is like what happens when you put Jaws, Wake and Fright, and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 into a blender, because the Baker brothers, Benny and Dicko, those are the type of characters that would have not stood out at all in Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. But since they're in this film, they definitely do feel they like do. They're out of a completely different
film. I feel like they had come out of the movie that I really love that we covered on this show, Plug.
Yes.
That was sarcasm, by the way.
Yes, I understood that. But I think, like you say, I think both Chris Haywood and David Argue do a great job in those roles as these very despicable, slimy, gross characters. And I also like the fact that the movie really doesn't even play with being realistic. Like even that the scenes where Betty and Dicko are working at that meat plant and they basically kill kangaroos to turn them into meat. Like it feels alien, that entire building. Like it doesn't feel like it's in the real world at all.
It almost feels like it's some like you said, like some fucking Texas Chainsaw Massacre shed kind of thing. It's like, why would you even be in there? And they're so disgusting.
Oh yeah, exactly. And also, I gotta say, the score by Ivor Davies from the band Ice House is amazing in this film. Like, it's a great score.
Yeah.
And this film was written by Everett DeRoach, who we have talked about a lot on the show, because he seems to have written nearly every exploitation film we have done on this show. I will say, though, I think compared to the other screenplays he has written that we have talked about, I don't think his script for Razorback is as good as the other ones. Like, it's a perfectly fine killer animal movie script, but it's not as interesting as the other work that he's done. But I feel like it's Russell Mulcahy and Dean Semler are what really their filmmaking and cinematography work is what really elevates a perfectly fine script into something that's visually unique and also can be quite intense and scary, because that giant boar animatronic that they use in this film is fucking terrifying.
It looks pretty decent. And yeah, I wouldn't want to come across that big pig. That's for sure.
Exactly. Exactly. And in terms of trivia on this movie, and a full-size, fully animatronic model Razorback was built at the cost of $250,000 and is only seen on screen for a few minutes. Now that I sort of think about that, the movie does take a lot of the Jaws approach where you barely see the boar throughout the film.
Yeah, you see it in glimpses and you don't really fully see it a lot, which definitely reminds you of Jaws. And the reason Jaws did that was because the bloody shark didn't work and it turned out all the more frightening for it.
Exactly. In the scene where the character of Beth Winters, played by Judy Morris, is in her car, she listens to a Duran Duran song called New Moon on Monday, which is playing on her radio before she is attacked. Director Russell Mulcahy made music videos for the hit new wave band before he landed his first motion picture job, Razorback. And of course, like, there's one trivia here that it says here that some commentators have written that this film may have been inspired by the 1980 death of Azaria Chamberlain, whose mother was accused of murder after a dingo purportedly snatched the infant, which you did mention before, Marcy. And it's kind of funny, though, especially that first half of the movie where Jake is on trial. Like, I always keep getting shades of the Azaria Chamberlain case every time I watch the film is during that opening scene. But that being said, though, like, how could anyone think that Jake had something to do with the kidnapping when half that house was taken out by the boar?
Well, apparently he went to such great lengths to pretend, but in their opinion, like, it's, yeah, I mean, like, you could sort of buy, like, okay, yeah, a dingo could have snatched your infant, they're out in the open, da da da. But this is like half the house is missing. And it's like, I think that would be way too elaborate to pull off. Like, yeah.
Exactly.
But I do get, like, again, I feel like because that was something that was fresh that had happened a few years prior, that something like that was in mind and sort of weaves the way to kind of get the story going with, like, this innocent person being accused of something, but we know that there's something more sinister out there. And I actually felt like that was Chris Hayward and David Argue, just saying. I'd rather deal with the pig.
Exactly. See, this is like, there's been the trend around at the moment, Marcy. Like, women have been asked the question, which would you rather meet in the forest, a strange man or a bear? I think we should make an Australian version of it is, women, when you're out in the outback, which would you prefer to meet, a giant wild boar or the Baker Brothers?
Yeah, exactly. And I think everyone's going to take the wild boar.
Exactly.
I think there's one more piece of trivia that is actually kind of hilarious, if you want to read that out.
Well, I'll read this, and I also have something else I do want to say as well, but I'll read this one because I know which one you're talking about. David Argue showed up on set one day with a big patch of his hair shaved, saying it was because his character had ringworm. He also stayed in character offset because he was kicked out of his hotel.
I don't know. That would have driven me nuts.
Yeah, I could imagine, because we have talked a lot about David Argue on the show, especially in the last two episodes, because he just randomly has been appearing in nearly every movie we've talked about. And I can imagine he would definitely be one of those method character actors.
Definitely.
And also, one thing I want to add is that the film actually received 6 nominations at the Australian Film Institute Awards that year. It actually won 2 for Best Editing and Best Cinematography. And I got to say, very well deserved.
Oh, absolutely. I was going to say, very well deserved. I agree with that.
Yep. And it was also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Original Music Score, Best Sound, and Best Production Design. So, yeah, I think it all deserved those nominations, and along with its 2 wins as well.
Definitely.
Actually, I have 2 other bits of trivia as well, Marcy. I think you'll be interested to hear. After the release of the film, Russell Mulcahy received a surprise phone call from Steven Spielberg, who was curious on how he achieved some of the effects in the dream sequence, such as the shot of the 2 moons. I gotta say, if Steven Spielberg rang me and asked me, how were you able to do this in your film, I would have just died right there and there, because I'd be like, it's Steven Spielberg, like, one of the greatest filmmakers of all time, asking me for film advice.
Yeah, I would have been like, this isn't Steven Spielberg. Fuck off. I don't believe in prank calls. And he rings back, excuse me, young lady. Oh, sorry.
I mean, that is true, and we should say it. And finally, Russell Mulcahy originally considered Jeff Bridges for the role of Carl, but producer Hal McElroy thought he had too little international appeal.
What? I was going to say, maybe it was because he was too expensive.
Maybe. But Jeff Bridges was already a two-time Oscar-nominated actor at this point, and he was in Starman the same year.
So they probably just said that, but really it was they couldn't afford him.
Well, that is true. I can definitely agree with that. So, but I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Razorback. And Marcy, what are your final thoughts and rating for this film?
I give this one 4. I would rather hang out with the boar than those two creepy guys out of 5. I think it's a great film. It's a great Aussie horror film. It's a great Ozploitation film. It's so visually like stunning to watch. And I think it just has this really good flow. It's got some good intense moments. And it's, again, one I recommend if people haven't seen it, or certainly worth a 4K rewatch.
Indeed. And I'm going to give this about a 3.5 out of 5. Like, even though, yes, that rating does seem low, but like I say, I think in terms of a script level, when you think about it, it is still a pretty straightforward killer animal movie in terms of plot. But I do feel like that both the filmmaking and the performances of the cast are what elevate it, for sure. Like, I think Russell Mulcahy's direction is great. The cinematography is absolutely amazing. The score is great. The performances are all really strong. And the boar at the center of it is just a truly scary design. And it's just used so effectively in the film. But like I say, the plot is pretty ordinary for this type of subgenre of horror, but it is still a really fun film. And if people haven't picked up the 4K version of this film, definitely do it, because 4K really just makes this film look spectacular. So definitely check out Razorback if you haven't seen it. Now, moving right along to our third film for this episode, it's what I'm very excited to talk about. And that, of course, is the 1985 erotic drama, Leonora.
Why don't you shoot it here?
What? In your home?
Well, unless you don't think the apartment looks good enough.
I think it looks sensational.
Well, it'll make a sensational commercial.
If you can persuade your husband.
Oh, don't worry. I'll persuade him.
Here?
Why not?
Darling, you don't film a car commercial in someone's apartment.
Why not?
Because it wouldn't look right. There's nothing to it.
Nothing to this?
Well...
Look, this apartment is me, my taste. You might have paid for it, but I created it.
I know, darling.
As I understand it, Simon, this is a very personal commercial. You can't get more personal than showing someone in their home.
Mm-hmm.
Well?
Well, what?
Do we do the commercial here?
I'll think about it.
Well, while you're thinking about it, finish drying yourself. Stop standing there looking like a degenerate ape.
Did you enjoy the party?
I thought it went very well. Darling, take your wet towel off the bed.
You're angry with me, aren't you?
Yes.
Why?
You might as well admit it, Simon. I saw you going off with Sandra tonight. Fine host you were, off screwing half the evening.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about that.
Oh, really? I'm listening.
Leonora, we've been married for 6 years. We've always been a very square couple. We ought to loosen up a little. We're comfortable and well off. Business is on the up and up. We ought to enjoy ourselves. Swing a little.
Speak for yourself.
An open marriage, Leonora. You have heard of it, haven't you?
Of course I've heard of it.
Then why don't we try it?
Simon, you can have as many Sandras as you want. Won't bother me. But in return, I want some public recognition for being your wife. Starting by filming the commercial here, at our home.
God, you're beautiful.
Which was written and directed by Derek Strachan. It stars Mandy Miller, Leon Marvel, David Evans, Angela Menzies-Wills, and Ron Becks. And the plot for this one, taken from IMDb, is the movie revolves around Simon Erickson, a Grand Prix driver now turned car dealer, his wife Leonora, and the director of Simon's new television ad, Mark. Basically, Mark and Leonora have met in a previous life and are destined to be together, no matter what. Now, one of the only reasons why I put Leonora on our schedule for this show was because I, of course, discovered it during my research on every exploitation film I could find. I had never heard of Leonora. I don't think anyone else on the planet has heard of Leonora, other than a select few, including us. So I wasn't sure what to expect from this film when I sat down to watch it. And let's just say there's a lot to talk about with this one. And Marcy, your thoughts on Leonora?
This film is as if you take the unfortunately cancelled soap opera Passions, but make it a softcore. And yes, that's the movie. That's my thoughts on it. That's literally it. It really is a sleazy Passions-esque soap opera, because you've got Simon, the car dealer. He's a total asshole. He's married to Leonora. He suggests to them they have an open marriage because he wants to fuck around, which he does very overtly. And then Leonora, her and Mark are drawn together. So then they start seeing each other. But then Simon doesn't like this in true man fashion, because he thinks he's getting something he wants, but he doesn't want her to get stuff because she's his as well. So it's still bullshit that goes on fucking 40 years later in the whole relationship dating scene. But as it goes on, like, he wants to close the marriage now because all jealous, blah, blah, blah. But you know, Leonora and Mark are like, I don't know, two tragic lovers. But then there's this whole other plot about, fuck knows, something about knowing, like, having all these lives and always being with Leonora in them. And I don't know if the lady was meant to be a witch or whatever, but then he starts fucking her and then she gets all upset because he wants to go back with Leonora. I think that's what the movie was about. Look, to be fair, the quality is like a VHS rip that is out there, so it's not the greatest. It can be hard to work out what's going on, but I certainly worked out some of what was going on, and I'm like, there's a lot of truths into, like, just men thinking, oh, I'm gonna have an open relationship, blah blah blah, but then as soon as the wife gets some action, he's like, no, we can't do it anymore. But it just I think what sold it is this weird shit with, like, this previous life stuff, and it's like, who are you people? What is this? That's Leonora.
Well, yeah, I think the only thing I knew about this film going into it is that it was an erotic film, and we have covered quite a few on this show, and let's just say they haven't all been the best. So I was kind of expecting the worst, as per usual, when it came to Leonora.
I will say this, out of all the, like, sex-related films we've seen, this is nowhere near one of the worst at all.
I'll say this about this film. It is batshit insane, and you're absolutely right. It does feel like a smutty version of an episode of the old TV soap opera Passions, and it just is weird. And also the character of Simon, Nora's husband, is it just me or does he look like Brian Fantana, the character Paul Rudd plays from Anchorman?
He does. Once you pointed that out to me, it's like, oh, I expect this guy to be like trying to deal in fucking Sex Panther cologne. And he's so gross and sleazy.
Oh, yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I don't want to kink shame people because that's not what we do on our network. But this movie kind of shows me, it's like, yeah, I don't think I would be into open relationships, because especially because he's the one who wants it. She just wants to just have a normal monogamous relationship. And just so he could just fuck around and have sex with many women as he possibly can. And we even see him where he basically gets into a freeway with the two women he's doing the TV ad with.
Yes.
And then hires for his car dealership. And basically he keeps telling Leonora, you need to go out and do it yourself.
He keeps telling her, go out and do it. As soon as she does, he's like, no, you're not allowed to. Typical male.
Exactly. So I will say this, like, it's definitely not a good movie, but it is a fascinating one and a strangely enjoyable one.
It is. I'm very fascinated by Leonora, and it's not a good film by any means, but I am very fascinated by it. And look, if this film didn't have the editor that it had, I don't think it would have made any sense at all. Like, the editing is legit the thing that saves the film, because it is coherent, and I think that makes it better.
Yes.
Because you get glimpses of what the fuck is meant to be going on, and you can kind of go with the flow, but it is such a weird and oddly fascinating film that, I don't know, I kind of recommend Lenora.
And also the dialogue is hilarious.
Oh my God. Some of the one-liners just come out of nowhere.
Like Simon's line, I'm like looking up some quotes now. Simon's line, do you really make a living out of that astrology crap?
I mean, people were saying that 40 years ago. They're still saying it now.
Mark, do me a favor and fuck my wife.
He kind of regretted that, didn't he?
Exactly. But yeah, it's just a strangely enjoyable film. Like, it's definitely a so bad it's a good film. But yeah, this is the thing I love about doing this show, Marcy, is that we've discovered quite a few gems during the course of this show. And I think we may have discovered like a diamond in the rough in terms of a possible, if it gets a re-release at some point in the future, maybe we have a new possible cult so bad it's good classic on our hands with this one.
Could potentially be that way, I think.
Yes. And there's no trivia on this movie, so we might as well go straight to our final thoughts and rating on this one. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on Leonora?
I give it 2 sleazy soap operas out of 5. And I recommend people try and find Leonora. It is the weirdest bloody movie I've seen for quite some time, and I'm fascinated.
I would recommend all of our audience to check out this film as well. I'm going to give this about a 2 out of 5, but it's a 2 out of 5 with love.
That's very true.
Like, as a film on its own, it definitely deserves that rating. And I will say the cast, I think, do a good job regardless. Like, some are better than others, but I think they do give quite memorable performances.
They give very soap operatic performances, and I'm all here for it.
But the fact that this movie is very insane, it's all over the place with its tone, and it even kind of ends on a cliffhanger as well.
And I was like, oh, okay. And it's like, wait, there's no other movie to watch. I'm never going to get a resolution now. Fucking hell.
But yeah, there was just so many moments throughout this film that made me laugh a lot. So I definitely recommend this one. Now, before we go on to our next film, there's a good reason why we don't have any trivia of this film. Well, the fact that IMDb didn't have any. However, though, we had something very special for our audience. Now, Marcy, you hinted at this before that you thought the film was very well edited. That's because you and I know someone in real life who actually was the editor of this movie, and we're going to interview him right now in this little segment. So the editor of the film is Anthony Egan, and he sat down to chat with us about the film Leonora. So here is our interview with the film's editor, Anthony Egan. G'day everyone, this is Beach Mind, and welcome to a very special interview for this episode of the Ozploid Cast. Now, just before, you just heard us talk about the 1984 erotic drama Leonora, so we have a very special guest joining us right now who knows a thing or two about this film because he worked as the editor of this film, and it's someone that both Marcy and I actually know in real life as well, and that, of course, is Anthony Egan, or as we like to know him as, Toad. G'day, Toad, and welcome.
Tone, just call me fucking Tone.
Okay.
Come on, leave out the fucking bit, just Tone.
He's not fancy, it's just Tone.
Exactly. You only go by one name, just like Cher.
People always ask me, your name's Anthony, why Tone? I go, it's one syllable, it's easier.
Exactly. Exactly. So we'll just refer to you as Tone for the rest of this
interview.
Just call
me Tone. Just call me Tone, please.
Exactly. Well, Tone, we're excited to talk to you about Leonora, which is a film that Marcy and I have just discovered for the Ozboy cast. But, and I guess our first question for you is, how did you get involved with this film?
Okay. Well, the producer, Jeff Brown, at the time was the associate producer of the multi-Logie Award-winning children's TV show, Simon Townsend's Wonderworld. I'd only been working, actually, just to back up a little bit, like, I was a kid, okay? I was a kid. I was like, I can't even remember the age because I just don't even think about my age. But I'd started working at Simon Townsend's Wonderworld as an assistant editor. And then I was lucky enough to get promoted to editor within a few months, which was pretty unusual, but it just happened. And so Jeff was there and we got on really well and what have you. And then one day he asked me, hey, I'm going to be making this feature film. Do you want to be the assistant editor on that? And I thought, oh, feature film. And I'm still at college. Like, I mean, this is... And I just thought, fuck it, yeah, feature film, cool. And then what happened along the way was that I got a call from Jeff one day, and he tells me, and actually the editor that they had lined up was another person from Wonderworld who was an editor. But I think I was basically asked to be an assistant editor, and I said yes, because assistant editor of a feature, sure. And you're working with... this other person, I'll tell you his name. His name was Andrew Aristides, who I think edited James Bogle's Kadaicha. And Andrew was a terrific editor, a really lovely guy. And we got on well. But then what happened is I get this call from Jeff one day just saying, hey, how about you edit the film? And I'm sort of like, oh, but I thought Andrew was cutting it. I'm just an assistant editor. Look, I'd been editing for, like, honestly, not very long as a profession. And the reason why I was being offered the gig was simply this, that they'd cast the film, they'd signed all the contracts, like equity, actors' equity contracts, right? And they went into a rehearsal and realised that the guy that they had signed for the hero role, whoever that was, I don't know. They just didn't like him in rehearsals. And so they decided to fire him. But because of the equity contract, they had to pay him out in full.
Oh.
They now had no money for an editor. Hey, Tone, we've promoted you. We're still paying you. So, yeah, and that was the thing. So they fired this actor. They had to pay him out in full, and that meant a chunk of the budget was gone. And now they can't pay Andrew. They can't pay an editor and an assistant. They can only pay one person. And Andrew's not going to be doing it because he'd been editing for, like, quite a few years before me. Yeah, I was still in college. I was a nobody. I still am. But, yeah, that's how it happened. That's how it happened. Okay. And so... I said, yeah, I'll cut the film.
And I guess with now being hired to edit the film, what was your thoughts on the actual footage when they sent it to you, basically say, oh, can you put all of this together? What were your thoughts on at least the footage that you saw the first time you received it?
Oh, well, look, it was handled as a proper film. And when I say proper film, in terms of the thing shot, the footage comes in, we review the footage, the director's there, blah, blah, blah. It was all done standard. It wasn't like they just threw a whole bunch of film at me. I mean, you've got to remember that this is analog days. It's not digital.
Mm.
Okay? You guys are a lot younger, so I'm pretty sure you're not that familiar with analog film, chemical processes, etc. It was a very different landscape. So no, it was handled as a regular film, but in terms of processes and how we go, it just was a really, really, really low budget film using the 10BA tax incentives. Do you know what the budget of the film was?
No, it doesn't. It
No.
doesn't say on any of the information I have read, so I'm kind of curious to know
Oh, I'll tell you
what the
right
budget
now, it
of
was
this film was.
$85,000.
Oh, wow.
$85,000, right? And it was shot in 11 days.
Wow.
That's impressive, considering everything and having seen the film. It always boggles my mind what can be done with so little.
Well, look, it is what it is. Now, the other thing was that it was so low budget that in terms of the editing, in terms of sound design, so it was just like, I would ask questions like, okay, so who are we doing the sound mixing with? And I think it was the same place that Wonderworld used sound mixing for. I can't remember right off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure it was. I'm 99% sure it was. But anyway, the thing was like, well, what about ADR? Like, if we need to re-record dialogue or whatever. No, can't do any of that. No money for it. Now, when I heard that, I changed my position. Well, I didn't change my position, but I just said, okay. So my work on the film, I was there when they were shooting on the day, and I was fucking boom swinging. Because I wanted all the audio to be recorded correct. Otherwise, it's going to sound like shit and there's no money for us to fix it. So I did all the audio recording on set as a boom swinger. Then after a long day working on the set, then I'd go to the fucking editing room and edit until whatever hours. So I was working, Christ knows how many hours, like 20 hours a day or something. But you've seen the film, you've heard the film. You can hear the dialogue, can't you?
Yes,
Yes.
I can actually hear the dialogue.
Yeah, so it was just a like it was just it wasn't the first time I've done it, and it wasn't the last time. But it's just like you get stuck being an editor, and then oh, we've got no money to do this or that, and it's like yeah, but we kind of need that. Oh, but we just don't have the money, and it's like. Okay, I'm going to be out on set every day and let the sound recordist know that I'll be boom swinging. And with Leonora, because the way it was shot, which was just very, very simply, and sometimes you'd have a crowd of actors, like six actors, maybe more, or what have you. You want to make sure they're all on mic, so it's recorded properly. And so, yeah, I just did that. And I look, I came from an old school sort of grew up making Super 8 movies and stuff. And so all that stuff lent into it. You just want to do the best you can with whatever limited resources you have. But yeah, so I just thought, right, okay, gotta do it. So there we go.
With you sort of needing the sound with the film, because without having sound, there's really no movie because there's no budget to do anything afterwards. And obviously, you're editing when it's not shooting. How long was the process for you to actually edit the film and sort of, but also just being on point with like, I need this audio, I need this audio.
Honestly, once I just sort of realized that the drama, and I think in terms of going on set and recording audio, I really can't remember exactly the day I went there, but me being me, it was probably first day because I was still in college, even though I had a good job. I just really, really wanted to ensure that it was at least a decent quality technically. The film itself's a pile of shit. It just is what it is. It's just soft core garbage. But for me, I just had to do the best I can. And so that was really important to me. And so, look, there's lots of stuff I can tell you. I can like the relationship with Jeff and the director, Derek. Now, Jeff and Derek were like your parents that argue all the time. I had to deal with that in the editing room, them having arguments like literally 2 feet behind me. In terms of the sound, Derek's a terrific composer. He's an awesome composer. Look him up and listen to some of his stuff. He's still alive and he still composes. Oh. And like in terms of the music for the film, we were using compositions that he'd done in the past.
Mm.
And he's a very, very talented composer. He's also a big porn addict. That was what was very clear making the film. Like, he liked to watch films where people are fucking.
And there's no lack of that in this movie.
Well, there would have been if they'd listened to me. And this is why I say the censored version that eventually played on, I think it was Channel 9 in the middle of the night, is so much better because it just cuts down all the sex scenes because they're really fucking boring. Yeah. And they were the arguments that I would have with Derek because it's the coverage being in terms of you've got a scene and you're going to cover it this way. We're going to do a wide shot, and then we're going to do a close-up on this, we're going to do this or that, or whatever. Coverage is about covering the scene and how best to create the scene. But we didn't have coverage. We just had, like, fucking, here's a wide shot. Oh, here's a couple of close-ups. Off we go. And so those sex scenes were just so incredibly boring. And I'd be editing them and just, like, Jesus Christ. Christ, we've got point of view looking at, like, okay, we've got a sex scene where it's like Mandy Miller's like straddling whoever, and it's point of view of whoever she, from the point of view of whoever she's straddling. Mm. And then it'd be like a reverse shot of the straddlee just going, oh, yeah, baby, whatever. And it was just fucking appalling. And there was nothing else. There was no real eroticism in terms of how it's put together. It was, and so I'd end up cutting these scenes. I'd be cutting these scenes. And I'd cut them so they were like tight in terms of, okay, this is kind of sexy and erotic if I cut them tight.
Yeah.
But Derek would come in and go, no. Let it play. And I'd just be going, let it play. Dude, you got 2 fucking shots until the fucking film's run out in the camera. And it was literally like he was just basically going, just take it from the camera stop, you know, and just like, I'm going, dude, I'm heterosexual and I find her really sexy as well, but this is boring as shit. Oh, No. And I remember specifically him saying, when I brought this shit up, and he going, no. They'll be looking at her tits. And I was just going, oh, God.
Yeah, but you can only look at a pair of tits for so long before you get bored.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. And Jeff, producer Jeff.
Yes.
Like, at one point, I mean, I was getting really, really frustrated with this. It was like all about, no, you've got to use every bit of footage where we're seeing her tits or whatever, right? And I was just going, oh, my God, this is, like, just so boring. And Jeff, at one point, I swear to God, he turned to Derek in the editing room and said, because Derek's arguing, oh, no, but no, the fans will want this. What fucking fans are you talking about? And Jeff just said pretty much, shut the fuck up. He's trying to save your movie. That is a quote. He's trying to save your fucking movie. We used to send, when Derek became a problem, true story, and we were working in this editing room in side of the bridge, north side of Milson's Point, something like that, right? And what we used to do is send him off to get donuts, but we'd send him to a place that was across the harbour bridge, somewhere like so random that it would take him like 2.5 hours, so he'd be out of our hair.
Yeah.
So we could just keep working on the film.
I can't say I blame you for having to do that.
Hey, Derek, I'm sorry. He's still alive. Sorry, Derek, if you're listening. You got to hear the truth, man.
I mean, you need to listen to your editor.
But yeah, we used to do that. We'd send him off for fucking donuts or whatever, and we'd just pick a place where we thought, okay, he's going to have to cross the Harbour Bridge and go way, way, way from us. And then we could get work done. Because he'd just argue and it was just ridiculous. Ridiculous.
Yeah. In terms of, I guess, like, I can't imagine there was much of a script, considering, like, the focus of the movie seems.
Oh, no, there was a script. No.
But, yeah, okay. So was everything shot that was in the script, or was there parts left out?
Was it
shoot this script kind of environment? Yeah.
The script was the script. It was shot in full. Yeah, that's it. And I mean, and it was really detailed as well.
Okay.
It's like, for because it's got all this occultism and stuff, right?
Yes.
I actually had an occult expert in the editing room to make sure that everything I edited in the scenes was on point. I kid you fucking not.
I like that dedication.
Like, they wanted to make sure that when I go to close-ups of tarot cards, they were in the right order.
Oh, okay.
That I didn't fuck it up, right?
Yeah, there is a lot of weird...
There was a lot of dedication to the occult and porn in this.
Yes, there is a lot of weird occult stuff in the film. There is previous lives, and there's so much going on, and it's like for me, watching it and being very fascinated by what I've seen, it does not surprise me that there was a lot of focus on the occult stuff. But again, not at all surprising that it pretty much just wanted to be like a hard, softcore type of movie with boobs all the time.
Yeah, it was like, I just remember when I can't even remember the person's name. I think they're credited, occult expert. And it's like making sure that my editing in terms of when the tarot cards are being read, that I'm making sure that's the right close-up for that one. That's the right. That's like, yeah, okay, it's whatever. Okay, fine. And I will say I never got anything wrong. And it was a lady, and she said, well done.
Oh, there you go. That's impressive. That's really impressive. Like, as someone who's not well versed, I wouldn't know.
My dad was like a paranormal dude.
Yeah.
Like, seriously. I grew up in a household of like just paranormal investigation, etc. Since I was a kid, and everything mystical and blah, blah, blah. I grew up, I was surrounded by it. So it's like, and I knew a bunch about tarot. So I was just like, yeah, I don't know what it is.
Someone who doesn't know much about that stuff, I could not tell if that was correct or not, but it's good to know that that's all very like authentic and how it is kind of thing.
Well, we tried to be authentic.
As much as you can with a small budget and everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I'm in it as well.
Oh.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm in it. Because as I said, it's like, fuck, man. It's so low budget and we've got no money for like proper sound post-production other than a mix. So we've got to make sure the dialogue's on point, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I'm in the film. Okay. There's the scene where the villain is in his apartment shooting the commercial, and he's talking about Simon Erickson, and he's got chicks either side of him, right? And then, because that's all about his wife gets into the director of his TV commercials, because Simon Erickson has car yard, whatever. Mm. Anyway, when it cuts back to end cut, I'm there with the microphone. Oh. Why? Because I want to make sure it's recorded properly.
Oh, that's great.
So geez. You'll see a
poor Tone trying to record the sound. Microphone
just probably in the back of my head, just going, what the fuck am I doing?
Jeez. But something tells me at the same time, you probably weren't the only one thinking that while working on this film.
Probably not. One of the funniest things was being on location because you were shooting and what have you. And we're on a break, we're having our lunch or whatever. And I sit next to the guy who plays Simon. And we're just chatting and blah, 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 blah. And he randomly, it was the most bizarre thing. But we're just talking about what we do, what we're into, yada, yada, right? And the big thing, I've got to say, the big thing was that we both loved Suspiria.
Oh.
Okay. And that was Dave Evans, the original lead singer of AC/DC.
Oh, wow.
He did a whole bunch of exploitation shit. But I didn't know him. But I knew the song, Can I Sit Next to You, Girl? Fuck yeah. And that was the thing. And I was just so blind. I was so stupid. I didn't know. We're just talking, and I'm talking about projects I'd like to make, and he's going, fuck, man, that sounds awesome, whatever. And I was like, oh, it's so, is this what you do normally? And blah, blah, blah. And, oh, I used to be in a band. And then I foolishly asked that question, what band? And it was just, he realized it was just like, fuck, I shouldn't have said anything. AC/DC. Oh, awesome, man. And hey, I'm a friend of his today. We still don't know each other because we've worked on other films together.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Another film that you will be covering.
Yes.
Being Come and Get It.
I was about to say, Come and Get It would be another one that he was worked on. Yeah. So we might talk to you about that.
Dave's fucking an interesting guy.
Well, I think with the work that you did, it's a film that you can actually follow, and it does make a bit of sense in the nonsensical. But I absolutely give you credit for how the film is put together.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, for me, it's just like I don't even think about it. I just find it funny when people bring it up.
It's one of those more obscure little films. And obviously with this podcast, we like to champion like all of these movies, whether they're shit or not. There's merit in everything.
Oh, yeah. I've worked on shit all my life.
And embrace it.
But I'm not responsible for the shit. I'm responsible for cleaning up the shit.
100%. You have the understandings, and so I say you should always listen to your editor.
Editors are the most important. It's not the director. It's not the writer. An editor is the one who's going to bring something. It's just the way it goes. The way it goes.
It is. And I guess we'll end on when you actually saw the finished product. Did you sit and be like, well, that was trash? Or were you like, I made something out of trash?
The latter.
Absolutely. You definitely did.
I could only do what I could do with the material that was there. And I worked my fucking motherfucking ass off to do something. Like, that's what a professional does. You do the best that you can.
Exactly.
Yep.
Exactly. Agreed. And I think I did say in the review, I think like the editing job on the film is what saves it. And 100% credit to you, Tone, because you really did. You made this make some sort of sense.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Well, I guess we will let you go, but I'm sure we will speak to you soon about Come and Get It, which we'll be covering on the show. I'm very excited.
Oh my God. There's an even better story.
Well, we'll leave everyone in anticipation. I think later in the year or early next year, I think we get to it. I can't exactly remember. Bede, you might have to...
Yes.
Help me there.
Don't worry, it'll definitely be on the episode list for this year.
Oh, it will be excellent.
Well, I guess that could be a wrap on our interview. And thank you so much, Tone, for taking the time to talk to you about the film Leonora with us.
My pleasure. It's fantastic to speak with you both.
And we'll definitely be speaking to you again soon when we get to...
Come and get it!
Can't wait, so everybody can stay tuned for that in an upcoming episode, and yeah.
All right, love you guys.
Love you. Thanks, love you too, Tone.
Cheers.
Well, there you go, everyone. That is our interview with Anthony Egan, or Tone, as we called him during the course of the interview. Thank you so much, Tone, for sitting down to talk about this wild movie with us. We deeply appreciate it. Now, we'll move right along to our fourth film for this episode. And that, of course, is the 1985 thriller Fortress.
Kill this one! Out! One! Two!
Bonnie!
Three!
Bonnie!
Four!
Bonnie, come back!
Five!
Don't
go, Bonnie,
they know!
Six!
Yahoo! One phone call with nine kids. They won't stall. The money will come floating from the bloody sky.
The terrorists. The children. The teacher. Players in a deadly game of hide and seek.
Get out of the car, boy!
Stay where you are! I'm getting closer! Don't run away!
Comes a fortress. The hunter becomes the hunted. Hell hath no fury like nine cornered kids.
Which was directed by Arch Nicholson. Written by Everett DeRoche, again, based on the novel by Gabrielle Lord. This film stars Rachel Ward, Sean Garlick, Mark Aidan Gray, Bradley Meehan, Rebecca Rigg, Beth Buchanan, Asher Keddy, Anna Crawford, Richard Triel, Vernon Wells, Peter Heer, David Bradshaw, and Roger Steven. And the plot summary for this one from IMDb is... After being kidnapped for ransom by four criminals, a school teacher and her students flee into a cave and build fortifications in anticipation of a decisive battle with their captors. Now, Fortress is a film that I have heard about for quite a while, and no, this is not the same Fortress that starred Christopher Lambert and was directed by Stuart Gordon, although one of the actors in this film was also in that one too, but we'll get to that momentarily. But Fortress is a film I have heard about for quite a while, and it's one that I've been wanting to see for ages. I'm very excited to talk about this one, but Marcy, your thoughts on Fortress?
Yeah, like you, Fortress is one I had heard about, and I think it might have been from someone from back in the Joe Blow days who, or Arrow in the Head days, who used to work on the site, had mentioned it and had to sort of be like, no, not the Christopher Lambert one. It's an Australian one. It's like, oh, okay. So yeah, I'd actually been anticipating watching it, especially seeing that we had it on the list. So it's like, okay, finally, I'll save it for the show. And yeah, like I thought this was, again, another really fantastic film. It's very intense and it is actually quite brutal. And when I posted that I was watching it, there was a lot of comments like, oh, this scared me as a kid. Yeah, if I saw it as a kid, I probably would have watched it a lot, but it probably would have freaked me out because it's not really a kid's film, even though it does involve kids in it. But it is like very full on because it's in like a rural town. A whole classroom of kids of different ages have been kidnapped with the teacher and they end up being put in this cave. So it is kids trying to survive something that is really, really harsh. And as it develops and they sort of get through the cave, but they still know the criminals are out there and they have to survive that. And it becomes very harrowing, but they also set up like all these traps to try and trap them. And yeah, it gets so full on. And by the end, it's like they've kind of become like a little bit savage after that experience. And I kind of like that. And we get a very cool cameo at the end with Terrence Donovan, which yes. I have to add, because I was like, ooh, this is a random cool cameo. But yeah, like what I really, some of the little things that I really liked with the film is the fact that with the four criminals, they all have masks and you don't see their faces. I think you see two of them, their face very briefly, if like in very small glimpses, like right towards the end. And I think that made them sort of seem a lot scarier and more sinister, especially because you were dealing with kids. And I did kind of mark out because I'm like, wait, Asha Ketty is in this movie. And then you see her and she's like a little kid and it's so adorable.
And let's not forget preteen Rebecca Rigg.
And also Rebecca Rigg as well. It's like some familiar faces in there. And I thought like at the time that they were kids, I thought they were actually really good. I can see people would say they might be annoying, but what I think really worked is that they felt like kids of those ages and it felt very natural for it. But it is really harrowing like what they all go through and then eventually like fighting back against them. It's I just think it's a really damn fine movie that I was absolutely like just hooked from beginning to end and just didn't know like what was going to happen. And by the end it's like, holy shit, that was certainly something.
Yeah, well, like I said, I kind of had a bit of a good idea what to expect with Fortress. And I knew that it was a kidnapping film, so I was expecting that. But what's interesting about this film, like, this could easily have been a straight-up kids' movie if they wanted it to be. But I think giving it that edge with the violence and the harshness of within the tone and just these really dark elements, it really just makes it stand out from other similar films. And you're right, though, when it comes to the kid actors, I could definitely see some people watching this film and finding a lot of the characters annoying. But at the same time, given the situation that they're in, it's very believable that kids would act this way. But I also love the fact that Rachel Ward, and who's just great in this film, even though she is the teacher, there are moments where she is even getting pissed off and frustrated with the kids as well. She's trying to keep everything in control so none of the kids get too upset or emotions escalate. And
not wanting to like traumatize them further and stuff and wanting to keep them safe.
Exactly. And even she has moments where she has to even tell some of the kids, oh, just shut up. Which is a very human figure. That's what I think makes her such an interesting character. Like, she could have easily have been played up as, even though she is a very strong character, but I think they could have made her as like an all-out hero character with no flaws whatsoever. But the fact that she does have her own little flaws and all that is what makes the character interesting, even though she is under all this pressure to look after all these kids. But at the same time, though, she wants to look after them and protect them from these criminals. And I like the fact that we never really get an idea why these criminals kidnap them. Like, there's no particular reason.
We sort of assume that it's for a ransom of some sort, but we don't know, like, who it would be from. Could it be one of the kids' parents? We don't really know. So I sort of like that we don't know what their motivation is, aside from possibly doing a ransom, which is what Rachel Waters, the teacher, just assumes, like, it must be for a ransom. But yeah, we don't really kind of know. And I like that those criminals are just very mysterious, that we don't know a thing about them.
You're right. And also the masks that they wear throughout the film. Like, you got the main criminal who has a Santa Claus mask, and the other ones, of course, have a mouse mask. One of them, I believe, has a cat mask. And of course, one of our favorites on this show, Vernon Wells, has a duck mask. And I know, like, you were messaging me before I started watching this film. You were like, "Be trying to guess which character Vernon Wells is." And for a while, I just assumed he was the Santa Claus character, because every time that character was yelling, it sounded a lot like Vernon Wells. But then I realized, oh, it's actually the duck character. But even then, though, like, Vernon Wells is probably the more well-known among the criminals in terms of casting. But he's barely in the film. And also, his death scene, I was literally taken aback by, because he's not killed by Rachel Ward or any of the kids. He's taken out by his own people. And then when Rachel Ward and the kids are sneaking out of the barn and she comes across him, she sees him there and she's startled. And then you realize he's dead, and then his body falls over, but his head is on a pike.
Yep. They kind of did the whole The Dark Knight beginning before The Dark Knight did it with, I'm going to take out the other guy so the share is more for me, which they even bring up at one point.
Yeah. And also there's some really creepy elements to it. Not creepy in terms of, like, the movie is creepy, but just kind of show, like, how, I guess, edgy the film can be, because there is even a scene where Rachel Ward and one of the boys discovers this lake within the cave, and they find a way out. And of course, the boy is oogling at her when she's taking off her clothes, and then she takes off her bra to get into the water. And I'm thinking, I know what the scene is going for in that moment. And I like the fact that even Rachel Ward kind of realized, oh shit, I better put something on, because this is making me uncomfortable that these boys are looking at me being half naked.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit uncomfortable. But you understand that situation is kind of dire. But also when they're going through the water in the cave, like, even though, like, she's meant to be the adult, she even gets stuck, like, underwater, and one of the students has to save her from that. And I think that it does help to sort of see the vulnerability for her as well during some of those moments.
Definitely. And then, of course, when it gets to the third act and they get to another cave and they decide to build a fortress to have their final stand against the criminals, that entire section is really well done in terms of the filmmaking and the action sequences. And you're right, though, it kind of just also shows on just how these characters, given everything that they've gone through being terrorized by these criminals, it kind of starts to make them even more savage as characters. Even the kids are doing really horrible things. Like, when they finally take out the head criminal, they basically have spears and they basically spear him to death over and over again. Like, all of the characters are doing it.
Yeah, like, by the end, it's do or die for them. And when we see, like, I think it looks like a heart in the jar in the classroom, which you assume is that guy right at the end that they killed. Like, it's such a shocking, but sort of ending, which I really appreciated. It's like, damn, they really went there.
Oh, yeah. It kind of just shows that after this whole incident, their lives are not going to be the same. And they basically savages. And I like the fact that in the scene where Terrence Donovan and one of the other police, they're in there questioning Rachel Ward about what happened, because they discovered that head criminal's body and it's been completely mutilated, and they suspect maybe they might know something about it. And then, of course, the kids kind of surround those two, and you get very unsettled by it.
Oh, very much so.
And in terms of trivia on this film is loosely based on the 1972 Faraday School kidnapping of a teacher in her class by Edward John Eastwood and Robert Clyde Borland. Eastwood later escaped from prison and repeated the crime with another teacher in his class in 1977. The Faraday kidnapping was in turn a real-life copycat crime based on a scene in the Clint Eastwood film Dirty Harry, where the Scorpio killer holds a bus driver and several school children hostage.
So essentially, this is Edwin John Eastwood and Robert Clyde Bolin. Pretty much like copied what they saw in a movie, and for what purpose? I guess a ransom. I haven't heard of this case, but I'm kind of interesting about it now.
Although I find it interesting that it's a Clint Eastwood film, Dirty Harry, that inspired these two guys, and also one of the guys' last name is also Eastwood.
Yes.
What is the odds of that? That's just bizarre.
It is bizarre. He's like, oh, he's got the same last name as me. I better repeat what he's fighting against in this Dirty Harry movie.
The production was made as a telly movie made for American audiences for the HBO pay television network and as a theatrical feature film for the Australian market. The picture debuted first in the US in 1985, with it being released in Australian cinemas in 1986, which I find very interesting because it is both a TV movie, but also not as well.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily feel like it's a TV movie. I think part of the reason why I've heard a lot of people from the US kind of mention that they saw this film is because it was on TV back on HBO.
Yeah, and also this movie kind of started a trend that just seems to happen with a lot of Australian genre films these days, where Australian genre films, particularly horror films, get released in other parts of the world first before they even come here, which I find very interesting, but also a little infuriating as well.
Yes, we should get things released ASAP.
Exactly, especially if they're from this country as well.
Yes, so we should see our own films first, damn it.
Exactly. The underwater scenes were filmed in a tank at a studio in Melbourne, Victoria, our city where we currently live. Lead actress Rachel Ward has said of this in an interview with a magazine published on the 23rd of November, 1985, 2 days before my first birthday, that the water was either too hot or too cold and had too much chlorine in it. We all got colds.
Yeah, I can't imagine wanting like to film in water and stuff, because it's never going to feel right.
Yes.
So I applaud them for having to go through that. That would have been absolutely insane.
Exactly. Cast member Vernon Wells would later go on to star in another film called Fortress, which we did mention. And yes, that is the same Christopher Lambert starring the Stuart Gordon director film. This was a 1992 science fiction action film, which was also an Australian production. So Vernon Wells started two Australian films that just happened to be called Fortress. Crew members, producer Michael Lake, costumer Phil Eagles, and stunt coordinator Chris Anderson also worked on both productions.
That's quite interesting. Like, same name, completely different films, but yeah, few similarities with people having worked on them. And I didn't realize Fortress was like filmed here.
Yeah, it actually was. Yeah, it's considered an Australian film. So we may have to put that on the Ausploitation docket, I imagine.
Yeah, if anyone hears this, do you think we should add the 1992 Fortress film onto the Ausploitation list?
Yes, definitely. But I also want to add a little bit of trivia. The film's director, Arch Nicholson, was actually involved with one of the three films we just previously talked about because he was actually a second unit director on Razorback.
Oh, there you go. Very nice.
And he will also direct his own killer animal movie with Dark Age, which we will talk about in a future episode of this show.
Well, that should be interesting.
Yes, but I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Fortress. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating on this film?
Yeah, I give this one 4 don't fucking kidnap me because I'm going to mutilate you and keep your heart in a jar in my classroom out of 5. Again, it's another film that I really enjoyed. I got a lot out of it. Again, something I'd really recommend. It's so fascinating to see a lot of these films that I feel like Fortress is something we should have seen like many, many years ago, but somehow just missed out on seeing it for some reason. Again, yeah, recommended viewing. It's a very good one.
Definitely. And I agree as well. I'm going to give this one about a 3.5 out of 5. I think it's a really well-made thriller. It's very intense. It does have its flaws here and there that stop it, at least for me, from giving it a higher rating. But I still enjoyed it overall. The cast are all great. Rachel Ward does such a great job in the film. And she's also gorgeous as well. So got to add that Brian Brown is a very lucky man. And it's well directed. It's well written. And I was just really kind of surprised on how dark this movie can get at times, given that a lot of the main characters were kids. So I was very surprised about that. So yeah, I definitely would recommend everyone check out Fortress. And hopefully this will be another one that'll get a proper release down the line, especially here in Australia, since it seems to be more well known in the US compared to here. But yeah, so that'd be 3.5 out of 5 for me. Now moving on to our fifth and final film for this episode. And like Razorback, it's also one of the big ones for this episode. And it happens to also be the third entry of a film series that we have talked about for this show. And we're going to be talking about the 1985 third entry in the Mad Max series, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
The world had been through a trial by fire, and only the greatest warriors and their deadliest enemies emerged from the flames.
Who are you?
Nobody.
Oh, mister, I can feel it. The dice are rolling.
He was the one they called Mad.
But he's just a raggedy man.
But to those whose lives hung in the balance...
Where's the whiting ones?
Whiting for what?
Whiting for you.
He was the one they called Hero.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, dying time's here.
Now, Mad Max is back in Beyond Thunderdome. Gibson, Tina Turner, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome,
which was directed by George Miller and George Ogilvie, and if I butchered your last name, please forgive me, written by Terry Hayes and George Miller. The film stars Mel Gibson, Tina Turner, Bruce Spence, Frank Tyring, Angelo Rosetto, Paul Larson, Angry Anderson, and Robert Grubb. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, is: after being exiled from the most advanced town in post-apocalyptic Australia, a drifter travels with a group of abandoned children to rebel against the town's queen. Now, Marcy, we have talked about the two previous Mad Max films on this show, which of course were Mad Max and Mad Max 2: The Road Warrior. Now, for quite a while, Beyond Thunderdome was the third and final entry in the series, until recently, until Mad Max Fury Road came out 30 years later. Now, Beyond Thunderdome, at least among the franchise, especially with these first three films, has always been the most polarizing entry in the series. Some people either love it, or some people don't like it at all. Some people are more in the middle. But it does have its fans. Roger Ebert was a huge fan of this film and gave it 4 stars out of 4 back in 1985 and called it one of the best films of that year. But the question is, though, what did we think of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome? Marcy, your thoughts on this entry in the series?
Yeah, I guess this is obviously the other one I had seen before, and I had seen this one many times. Growing up, I remember this one played on TV quite a lot, and it was definitely more than the other two, and I don't know what it was. But there's something that, at least with the first three, Like, while people generally say, like, the Road Warrior is their favorite, but it feels like Beyond Thunderdome had the more iconic imagery that was always associated with Mad Max. So I find that quite fascinating. And, yeah, I'm not sure why it played on TV a lot, but maybe it was because it was more accessible for younger kids, because a big part of the film is actually the abandoned children that come into it as well. So, yeah, I have fond memories of it. I actually had completely forgotten, like, when we get the first, like, battle in Thunderdome, that they're, like, attached to the freaking wires and stuff. And it's so hokey and silly, but it's also great at the same time. And you know, I saw, like, remembering that actually happening, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. And there's so many other little bits and pieces, like, remembering from the film. But as a Mad Max film, I think it does sort of flow with this, like, mythological sort of character like Max, which I feel like was more, we saw more of that with the Road Warrior, but I think it's more here, he's more of a mythological type person. And you do, like, between the films, you do gradually see, well, not gradually, but it's kind of from one movie to the next, like, things have gotten a lot different as this post-apocalypse has continued. So, like, Mad Max 1 is sort of just as it's starting. 2, it's definitely well and fully in there. And 3, it's just like we've got so much going on. But I do actually really enjoy Beyond Thunderdome. It could be because of that nostalgic childhood reason, but I genuinely, like, again, just had a lot of fun rewatching it. And I absolutely love Tina Turner in this film. She did not have to go as hard as she did. And we're forever thankful that she did, because it is a very iconic role in it. And I got to say, Mad Max's hair through a big portion of the movie is absolutely hilarious.
Indeed, indeed. That's funny, though. You mentioned this before, and I have to agree. Like, even though, at least of the first three Mad Max films, the first Mad Max, iconic Australian film, when people think of Australian exploitation films, that's the first film they think about. Mad Max 2 The Road War is one of the greatest action films ever made, and definitely was the film that kind of kickstarted the post-apocalyptic action genre that we would see in the 80s and beyond. And it also has some truly amazing action set pieces. But you're right, though. When I rewatched Beyond Thunderdome in prep for this episode, it really got me thinking, out of the first three films in the series, is Beyond Thunderdome the most iconic? Because every time when I think of the pop culture zeitgeist when it comes to the first three Mad Max films, like in terms of references, dialogue, characters, a lot of it actually comes from this film, which is very interesting to me, given that this is one of the more polarizing entries in the franchise, given that it is a film that is either loved or hated by the fan base. But at the same time, though, it definitely is the most iconic. I can't tell you how many times I've heard the term Thunderdome mentioned a lot throughout my life. I think we even talk about it every now and again as well, or even just joking, like, ah, two people enter, one man leaves. It's like, oh, they're gonna have their own Thunderdome going on here. It's like we always reference this entry in the series.
It just, I don't know, maybe it's just the imagery is just very iconic. But it's like you think of things like the California Love music video being obviously referencing Thunderdome. Like, it was in pop culture, like, quite a lot. And even, like, the Mel Gibson Simpson episode was called Beyond Blunderdome.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, these are just the ones I think off the top of my head. But a lot of imagery for Mad Max. And you certainly had a lot with Tina Turner. Maybe that's part of it because she was in it. But, yeah, it is, I would say through my life, it's the one I've seen the most because it was always on TV.
Yeah, I can agree with that. And you're right, though. As great as Mel Gibson is in this entry in the series, and he's been great in all three films as Max, it really is Tina Turner who steals the whole film with her performance as Auntie Entity. I know this role was written specifically for Tina Turner, and she just nails this character. She's every time she is on screen, she is just magnetic. And I think she's definitely one of the great villains that have appeared in this franchise. But I think what's also great about her as a villain as well is, like, yeah, she is a villain, but she is kind of an anti-villain because you do understand her as a character. And being that before the world fell, she was someone who had nothing. And then when it did, she built this entire town, a barter town, from scratch and basically has become the queen of it. So you can definitely understand why she feels threatened by the character of the Master, one half of Master Blaster, who, because of knowing that he knows how to create the energy for this city, he feels like, oh, he's the real king of this place. So her power is being threatened by it. So you can definitely understand that. But I feel like when it comes to Auntie Entity and Max, I think one of Tina Turner's last lines in the film where she says to Max, like, oh, aren't we a pair? Like, they're both survivors in their own ways that have built themselves up from tragedy in their previous lives and were able to do more in this post-apocalyptic world. So there's definitely common ground between these two characters. But even then, though, Tina Turner is just so fucking good in this movie. And
I really wish she had done more movie roles.
Oh, yeah, she's just so magnetic and charismatic on screen, and her wardrobe in this film is phenomenal and iconic.
It is. It's very iconic.
And also, I mean, we got to say it, this film has probably one of the great songs for a movie of all time with We Don't Need Another Hero, which Tina Turner sings as well. And it's a great song, and it gives me chills every time it's played.
It's
over
a great song.
Oh, yeah. And also, you're right, though. It does continue kind of more of the world building of Mad Max, or at least adding more to the mythology that we know of the franchise. Like, yeah, the second film kind of had all that, but I feel like this film kind of dives into it a lot more, which I found very interesting.
But I think, especially with this film, like, it feels like it's a story that's being told from generations in the future from where they are. And that Max is like this mythological type hero, but then you still have this interesting and complex villain. And you did get that, I think, with the Road Warrior, because it is sort of like narrate or being told from certain points of view. But I feel like this just added to that more. And that's kind of what I get from it. But yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I can definitely see at the same time why people are so mixed on this film. Like, it does feel like two separate movies just slammed together, because you have the stuff in the first half of the film with Barter Town, and then the second half with the kids. And it does feel like two completely different movies. But that being said, though, what I find interesting about the second half, and I really noticed this on this recent viewing, is that the second half definitely had a lot more of a Steven Spielberg vibe.
Yes, it did. It did. And it does change up, like, when he does come across the kids. And again, this adds to that mythological type thing, is that they think he's like this savior because of previous stories and retelling stories from the ones who came before them. So I think that just adds into that more, even though, like, as you say, it feels more like a Spielberg type thing. And it's certainly more kid friendly for kids to watch almost.
Oh, definitely. And also, I have to admit, though, like, I mean, the action set pieces in this film are great. I do love the Thunderdome sequence, as silly as that.
It's so silly, and I love it.
And also the final section of the film with the big chase with Arnie Entity chasing after Max and the kids who are on the train. Like, that whole sequence is great. Maybe not on the same level as what it was in Road Warrior, but it's still a great sequence. But I know, because there's two directors on this film. George Miller directed the action set pieces, while George Ogilvie, and again, if I butchered your name, please forgive me, directed the non-action set pieces. And there's a good reason for that, which we'll go into in a sec. But watching that entire sequence, like, I could definitely see George Miller's love for silent cinema a lot in these sequences, particularly with Angry Anderson. Basically, his character of Iron Bar, basically, like, all of his scenes feel like they're out of a cartoon. Like,
it does.
Like, Iron Bar's basically the coyote, and Max and the kids are the roadrunner.
Yeah, there's a lot of shit in that movie. Deservedly so, though.
I mean, yes, and like,
when you think, why isn't he dead yet?
I was gonna say, like, you think the character's dead, and then he just comes back to life out of nowhere.
Yeah, it really does. And I think, like, with this film, more it has more of that old Western type feel as well. I think there's certain like elements that it is like a futuristic Western style, like post-apocalyptic film, but there's a lot of like Western sort of tropes that you find in there as well, which I find interesting.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And
I think that kind of adds to the film as well.
Yes. And also this film would also start the trend with the franchise where clearly George Miller doesn't really give a shit about the continuity of his films, because Bruce Spence is back, but he's not playing the same character as the gyro captain from Mad Max 2, but it's another character that's very similar to the gyro captain.
Yeah, I know George Miller has said, no, it's not the same character, but come on, it's the same fucking character. There's no difference.
Yeah, I like to imagine it is the same character, because that would only make sense, especially when Max sees him for the first time and he's like, you, it almost has that like look like I recognize you from somewhere.
See, it's like in number two, I forgot that metal underwear wearing guy was called. The other one with the helmet, yes. Mungus, I think.
Yes.
Like how that was meant to be Goose, but then it wasn't. But I'm like, you know what? It works though if that is Goose, because then you see the progression of people through this post-apocalyptic world.
Definitely. And the score by Maurice Jarre I think is also great as well. But in terms of trivia of this film, here's a couple that I find very interesting. Tina Turner had to shave her head for her wig to fit properly, and she reportedly had no problem with that. So good for you, Tina Turner.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? She knew she was going to look fucking amazing, so she did it.
Exactly. And that's why it's no surprise to me, like, over the years, like, when she did concerts and all that, Tina Turner would also bring out her Thunderdome outfit for all the concerts whenever she sang We Don't Need Another Hero. So, and also, the sandstorm at the end of the film was real, and a camera plane flew into it for some shots. The storm in its entirety hit the crew in the desert, forcing them to ride it out in their cars wherever they could find a cover.
Yeah, that sounds absolutely fucking frightening.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But then again, knowing that the late, great Grant Page was the stunt choreographer and coordinator on this film, that would also make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. Also, the possible outcomes on the wheel are acquittal, amputation, auntie's choice, death, forfeit goods, gulag, hard labor, life imprisonment, spin again, and underworld.
See, so, if I had the will, I'd be like, acquittal, let's go.
But also, I do love the fact that George Miller really kind of goes into the world building of this franchise, like with these little details, which I find
really interesting. So it's interesting how the sort of things work in this barter town. And it's like this glimpse into how people will try to survive and make a society in this post-apocalyptic world.
Hmm.
Which, for some reason, in the post-apocalypse, there's a lot of shit happening.
Mm. At the time of shooting, this was the most expensive film to be made entirely in Australia.
Not surprising at all, because it looks like it would have costed a pretty penny.
Oh, yeah. Like, the budget for this film was $10 million US. And also, kind of to compare it, Razorback, I believe, was actually $5 million. So Australia is definitely going up in terms of big budget productions at this time.
Mm.
Although this film was the least successful of the Mad Max series, the term Thunderdome has come into common usage and is referenced in much popular culture, which we had talked about before, and I honestly do believe that. A common misconception is that George Miller later agreed to direct the action set pieces, with George Ogilvie directing the rest of the film. This was debunked by Miller himself, claiming that the assumption was made because of ambiguous press releases. In fact, the only time the Georges split up was while Ogilvie was filming the camel sequences. Otherwise, they spent most of their time together on set. But I think what's also interesting, too, to kind of add on to that, I think the reason why a lot of people kind of assumed that George Miller, at least on this entry, only directed the action set pieces is that his longtime producing partner, Byron Kennedy, who also produced the previous Mad Max films, died in pre-production in a helicopter accident while scouting locations for the movie. And I know George Miller wasn't in the right frame of mind to fully direct the film due to his loss. So that's why George Ogilvy, who actually directed a few TV miniseries of that George Miller actually produced with his company with Byron Kennedy, brought him on to co-direct this film with him. So it definitely kind of makes sense in that regard. But also, Marcy, now we talked about in Fortress had a couple of young future Aussie actors in the cast with Rebecca Rigg and Asha Kenny. This film also has one as well. The role of Anna Goanna was played by Justine Clarke, who, of course, would go on to be a major kids entertaining star.
Yes, that is quite wild that Justine Clarke was in this film. Just another little bit of trivia that I think is quite weird. Apparently, there were 600 pigs in Underworld. Buying that many could have hurt the pork market, so they had to rent the pigs from a pig farmer.
That's a lot of pigs.
And Australia loves their pork, apparently.
I mean, given
not as much as lamb, but
this was a weird time in Australian cinema. Between the course of a year, we had Razorback and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome with a lot of pigs in movies.
Apparently, it's just all about the pigs.
But also, Marcy, given that there were a lot of pigs in this movie, would this movie have given George Miller to make the movie Babe?
Maybe he was so enamored with the pigs, he was like, I'm going to make two Babe movies.
Exactly. Exactly. But I guess that could be a wrap on our discussion of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And Marcy, your final thoughts and rating for this film?
Yeah, I give this one 3.5. I don't need another hero, but I'll probably take one anyway, out of 5. I have a lot of love for Beyond Thunderdome. I really enjoy the film a lot. It's great to rewatch. And again, it's something that, again, it probably is nostalgic for me because of my love for it as a kid, but I just think it's genuinely a really fun and interesting film. And I just like the progression between like 1, 2 to 3. And then as we later see with like Fury Road, just how different things sort of progress. But this just interesting sort of mythology around Max being this drifter type character, getting into these situations. And again, if you haven't seen this for a while, check it out. I mean, as of the time of recording, Furiosa, a Mad Max saga or story, I can't remember the title, has recently been released. So I think Mad Max is kind of in the air a little bit. So yeah, rewatch Beyond Thunderdome.
It's not like we put this movie in this month to be in time with the release of Furiosa or anything like that. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
No, we didn't at all, because like, if we'd stuck to the schedule, we would have covered this like 2 years ago.
Indeed. Well, I'm going to give this one 4 out of 5. Like, I really enjoy Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome a lot. Is it a flawed film? Definitely. Like, I can definitely see the problems that a lot of people have with this film, particularly that it does feel like two movies in one. And it is a bit jarring going from one to the other. But that being said, though, it still is a very entertaining film. Mel Gibson, once again, is great as Max. And this would actually be Mel Gibson's last Australian production that he would work in for quite a number of years until he came back in the 2010s to make the film Hacksaw Ridge. So yeah, that's another bit of trivia right there. But I think it is just a really fun and entertaining film. Like, it's full of memorable dialogue, memorable scenes, great characters, and again, Tina Turner is fantastic in this movie. The stunt work and action set pieces are great. The music and score, like I am convinced that this is the most iconic entry in the franchise, at least until recently with Fury Road. But I think of the original first three, this is definitely the most iconic entry of the franchise.
Yeah, it just sort of became the iconic, like, Mad Max movie with everything in it. It's weird how that happens.
Yeah, and I guess for a lot of people at the time, especially in our age bracket when we were young kids, this would have been the first Mad Max entry for us all, because in the US, the film was rated PG-13. and here in Australia was rated M, which I believe would have made it the first Mad Max film to be rated M in Australia. I could be wrong about that, but then again, I could get things wrong
all the time. It's fine.
Well, that is true. But yeah, I would definitely say, definitely check out Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. It is a great third entry in the franchise. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is a wrap for this episode of the Ozploid Cast. And once again, thank you, Marcy, for being a very awesome Aussie co-host and talking about all these awesome Ozploitation films with me.
You're very welcome, mate.
Indeed. And yeah, so actually the next episode of the Ozploid Cast will be out a little bit sooner rather than later, because our schedule this month has been a little all over the place. So you'll be getting two Ozploitation episodes at least within a few weeks of each other. So stay tuned for the next one, and I will tell you all momentarily what the films are going to be on that one. But before we wrap up the episode today, Marcy, where can people find you and also everything the Ozploid Cast out there on the internet this week?
Yes, you can head to supermarcy.com and you can find all the Ozploit casts there. But you can also go and subscribe and listen to the podcast on all your regular podcast players such as Apple Podcast and Spotify. And you can find the Super Network on your socials. Check out the Super Network link tree for that. And me personally, I'm Super Marcy on all the socials and Super_Marcy on Letterboxd.
Awesome. And if people were to find me personally out there on the internet, you can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jamide. You can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com. And also you can listen to my solo podcast, Bede vs. the Living Dead, and as well as its spinoff show, Bede and Steve vs. Care Crystal Lake, on all podcast streamers everywhere. So, yep, that is a wrap for this episode of the Ozploit Cast. I hope you enjoyed this 17th episode, everyone. And look out very soon for episode 18 of the show, in which we will be diving into the films Wills and Burke, Wind Rider, Frog Dreaming, Fair Game, and Frenchman's Farm. So stay tuned for that episode very soon, everyone, and we'll see you all later. See everybody. Bye.
Bye.